friends. Welcome to episode 254 of Storyteller Conclave. This is a show all about helping you run the best tabletop role-playing game that you can, whether you're a new storyteller or dungeon master learning the craft, or an experienced storyteller looking to take your game to the next level. I'm Sarah.
I'm Rob.
How are we doing, Rob?
I'm trying to get your soapbox just in the right position. I want to make sure it's stable.
Just like an inch to the left.
Okay. Let's here.
And we're good. Here? Yes.
Okay.
We are good.
Let me get into my sitting position. I'm going to be comfortable
get
for this.
Get comfortable. Yes. Get a blanket.
I got your tea.
You've got tea.
We've got
yeah.
tea. We're all set here.
All
so,
right.
So yeah, we have a show.
We do. Do we?
I have a show.
So. Do we want to just roll right into it, or?
I feel like we have to, only because there's a lot to cover and a lot of feelings, and I feel like some of these simple statements that you have on this sheet in front of me is going to go into a much longer conversation.
Yeah, probably will.
We may wander just ever so slightly.
Yeah. So tonight we are talking about the negative impact that D&D has had on the hobby. And this is a topic that I personally feel very passionate about. I am a D&D, an ex-D&D DM.
Mm-hmm.
I have played several editions of it, most recently 5th edition, for about half of my campaign and whatnot. And there's just, it's been a frequent source of frustration for us, I think, here on the show and whatnot. And I've spent a little bit of time in a lot of different shows talking about it, and mm-hmm. kind of wanted to just pull out the old soapbox and mm-hmm. just air all the dirty laundry at once.
Yeah, put the grievances out there. Now, to be square,
mm-hmm.
D&D is effectively what started me getting into gaming at all.
Yeah, sure.
But it wasn't really my first game. It was mm-hmm. where I created my first character, and I technically played a little bit with my cousins, but I didn't actually have a taste of it until much later.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until I got my hands on some second edition books after I played Palladium.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And got through that kind of stuff. So Palladium was my first, and D&D was my second, but it still had a ridiculous impact on me. And to say enough that, like, Palladium was impacted by D&D
mm-hmm.
heavily, like,
oh,
and,
sure,
and super
sure,
influenced
sure, sure.
by it. But it's not that, like, I don't have animosity toward people who play it.
Yeah.
Or anything like that. But it definitely is, and in most recent years has had even, I think, a much larger impact. I think its initial impact was culturally and indicative of the times of what it was trying to be in a mm-hmm. world of board games.
Yeah, yeah.
And then as time went on, it evolved, and the culture evolved, and it evolved, and everything else evolved around it without it changing.
Right, right.
Like, I think 3 was when I stepped in and realized how much it was trying to change.
Right.
It was the awkward teenage years of D&D, without a doubt.
Oh, by far. I would dare say actually 4th edition was its awkward teenage phase.
I would kind of agree with that.
That was when I think a lot of people bailed on it, because they realized they were taking it too far in that sort of video gamey, board gamey direction. And then with 5th edition, they tried to recorrect and get it back on course as more of a traditional role-playing game. But I think it still carries a lot of baggage mm-hmm. along with it. And even as it's kind of shifted editions and whatnot, the entire role-playing genre has kind of shifted in a lot of ways. And I feel like while D&D was trying to reinvent itself from 4th into 5th,
mm-hmm.
All other games kind of moved away from where it was, and kind of left it sitting. You know, the cheese stands alone.
I think rightly so. The creators of D&D, those who worked at TSR and eventually Wizards of the Coast, and mm-hmm. now even Hasbro, many of those designers left to make other games, and those games are vastly different than D&D because they felt that had been done, and it was that was an end point, not a start point.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of thing. It's like, we left it at its state mm-hmm. and moved on.
Right.
And you see that in a lot of other industries, but it's rare that you see the monolith of the industry.
Mm-hmm.
The be all, you know, be also, like, the standard bearer and, like, line marker to say this is where all things begin
mm-hmm.
in the culture, and for as long as it has.
Yeah,
Yeah. Like, without a doubt, it has held that position. Like, we know the term Kleenex, and we know the term Xerox.
Yeah, and I
because
mean,
of the same kinds of things.
Look, and I hate it. I cringe inside when I do it, but I don't tell people I'm playing role-playing games or I'm playing Savage Worlds this weekend. I tell people I'm playing D&D. Why? Because they'll know what that is.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And if they want to know anything else, I'll tell them, okay, well, it's a variant, you know, it's a different type of D&D, it's, you know, blah, 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 or whatever. But, yeah, but I mean, the most lay people that are not in the, you know, in the hobby, you tell them you're playing D&D this weekend.
Yeah.
You know? So, I want to start off kind of by saying, like, why am I doing this? Why am I like this? because I don't want people to think that I'm just a hater, right? Okay. I mean, okay. I like you said earlier, I don't hate people who play D&D. Like, I'm glad they're part of the hobby, you know? I call those people my peers. I call those people my friends, my brothers, my sisters, my siblings, you know, at the table. And I'm glad they're enjoying in the same sort of hobby that I am. I think rising ships raise all boats, you know, that sort of thing. But you can't just look at D&D in a vacuum, you know? Yeah. And I don't hate the player, hate the game, as the old saying goes.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I'm doing here.
Yeah.
And I think it's not only important to look at the games themselves, but the culture that they manifest around them.
Now, I do want to state that we are not going deep into the culture wars of D&D and what happened there.
No.
We're
going to
look at it from the game
perspective. That's not the culture I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is the sort of habits that so I oftentimes say games teach you how they want to be played, right? And D&D has a very particular way in which it wants to be played. And it tries to be the alpha and omega of all tabletop role-playing games. And so that leads to a lot of problems, which I will enumerate shortly. So let's start there, actually.
Okay.
The D&D markets itself as the flagship product for the tabletop role-playing game hobby.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it's really... It's branded like as a lifestyle brand, you know, almost like Apple is, you know, Apple, Adidas, you know, where it's not just a hobby. Like, you buy products with the D&D logo on it, you know.
Right, right. D20 was marketed during Wizards of the Coast as a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they were the flagship of that style of playing. If you played a D20 game, it was D&D like.
Yeah, exactly. And you look at all the like we have D&D celebrities now. You know,
yeah.
There are multiple shows playing D&D that are live plays and stuff. That there are multiple podcasts out about it and whatnot.
We finally
and
have it, a recognized good, not only from the grognards and players, but also from community outside in movie land who say this movie is a good movie, and we're like, and it is a good representation of a D&D story.
Absolutely.
And that says a lot about something that is relatively small when you think of the cultural size of D&D. That's huge. Like, you rarely get like a horse race story. That everybody's like, is a good movie that you want to see, and it's very much accurate about horse racing.
Yeah, sure.
And horse racing is much larger.
But, I mean, that's really just to say that their marketing has been successful, and they have that sort of market presence, that sort of ubiquity in the zeitgeist within the culture, right? People who aren't familiar with tabletop RPGs at least know the name D&D.
Yeah, it's impregnated itself in movies, TV shows.
And I believe to a major extent, and I may not be correct about this because I don't interact with the darkest corners of conservative America, but I mean, the Satanic Panic is a thing of the past, you know. I think it's outlived its old Satanic Panic roots.
I would say in the general sense, yes.
I saw a Twitter thread or something like that from, I want to say it was Monty Cook, actually, who was talking about how back when he worked for TSR, they were trying to, he was going to do a thing about using Lego figures as minifigs for
inexpensive
for his things.
Gaming, yeah.
And they TSR owned Gen Con back at that time.
Yep,
so
yep.
Basically it was his job to reach out to Lego to see if he could get a sponsorship. And he was going to offer them, you know, advertising and stuff like that in the Gen Con, you know, pamphlet mm-hmm. and whatnot in exchange to see if he could get some free product to help offset the cost of setting up this panel that he wanted to do. And got bounced around corporate for a little bit until he finally got someone to talk to and basically got as far as saying, hey, yeah, I want to do this for my D&D game. And they went, D&D?
Like the Dungeons and Dragons?
Like the thing with the demons and stuff? Oh, Lego can never be associated with something like that.
Yeah.
And all these years later...
Because there he's posting it now, yeah.
Lego has a D&D official...
Yeah.
Product.
Yeah, and it's now at the 50th anniversary and their masters are doing like a showing of it, like they're running a game mm-hmm. on the Lego site to kick it all off, and they understand that there's a huge market share there.
Yeah. Lego can never be associated with a product.
I guess
like
that. Not, you know.
Yeah. So okay. But it's because of this ubiquity. In their marketing, in the minds of people,
mm-hmm.
that a lot of people who aren't aware of the diversity of this hobby
mm-hmm.
ascribe their feelings about D&D to all tabletop games.
Yes,
because D&D is synonymous with tabletop games in their minds.
Yeah,
you know?
Kleenex is a tissue.
and if you have a bad D&D experience. That may put someone off tabletop RPGs for good.
Well, I mean, it's,
we know someone who's that happened to.
We've known several people. We definitely know some specific people. But I mean, it's because they're coming from it at multiple angles. There is not a single cultural image.
Mm-hmm.
If your experience is you like watching Community and you see them play D&D, that is one view.
Right.
Very different from the kids in E.T. who played D&D
mm-hmm.
versus Stranger Things.
Right, right.
All of these are different aspects of the same thing versus Critical Role, which a lot of, there's a huge number of players right now who never knew anything about it.
Well, we'll get to that point. We'll get to that point because the diversity of different experiences you can have across the board is another aspect of this. But we're going to elaborate on that in a bit, but... The problem is we can't just say that D&D hurts the new player experience without laying some groundwork as to why it's a bad experience.
That's fair. Okay.
So we kind of need to work into, like, now we have to display our evidence.
Okay.
So the first point is it markets itself as a one-size-fits-all system.
Mm-hmm.
And it is not.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. It is
very not. In fact... In a lot of ways, unless you're comparing it directly to, like, Pathfinder, which is essentially just a D&D offshoot, it's the ugly duckling in the room at this point.
Yeah, I would agree.
If you're comparing it to a lot of modern systems,
yeah,
it's the ugly duckling in the room.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so new players, especially those who watch Critical Role, they're going to expect a game... to play more narratively than it actually does.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you've come into it watching Critical Role, Dimension mm-hmm. 20, something like that. Okay.
Right.
Those are very story focused D&D games.
Mm-hmm.
However, once you're at the table though, a lot of new players are finding themselves, facing a very different reality than what they're seeing in these live play shows that have attracted them.
Yeah.
They're frustrated with the number of rules.
Agreed.
I mean, I've got seasoned role players who sat at my table, and we still, like, when we parted ways with D&D 2 years after we started playing it,
we still
had players there that weren't quite sure about how to run certain things on their own character sheet.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
They're bored with the combat, which is long and often unnecessary.
Well, I mean... Yes, I agree that it's unnecessary, but at the same time, D&D forces it to be necessary.
It forces it to be necessary, exactly.
Yeah.
And the culture kind of encourages people to optimize their quote-unquote build. You know, it plays a lot like a video game. It is with an emphasis on DPS rather than being allowed to focus on the story.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I mean, I'm sure we've spent a lot of time talking about how basically every character is a combat character.
Yeah.
You don't have the luxury of playing a social character. You can play a bard who has some social abilities.
Right.
But that's about it. Like, if you want to play a social fighter, there's not really a lot of great options for you to do that.
Well, I think, and that kind of puts on to the next thing, is that it is, that even though you make that statement that it has to sit within that framework, that's part of the lack of consistency.
Yeah.
Because you'll have storytellers right now who are listening to this going, no. I run a bard game where all the players in my game are bards, and they're all talky and play, like, they're all musicians.
Sure.
But you're also not running D&D, you're homebrewing some kind of a situation that sits within that.
Exactly, and I can open a beer bottle with a screwdriver, but it doesn't mean it's the best tool for the job, buddy.
That exactly is the point.
It just means it's a neat trick I know how to do, you know?
But because of that, when someone sits down and has an expectation that it's going to be Critical Role, or has an expectation that it's going to be a dungeon crawl, right? Because that's what they saw, and it isn't. It's ridiculous amounts of whiplash.
Yeah.
That one, in just a single experience.
Yeah, and even within core D&D, you're not really quite sure what you're going to get, because being that it is a mass marketed game from Hasbro, a billion-dollar company, and they want to constantly churn out products so that they can constantly churn in profits, you know, unlike most other games where it's like, I'm just glad the rulebook got put out there. I'm glad you're reading it. It's here for free.
Yeah.
You know, get the PDF for $10 up on DriveThruRPG. I'm not trying to fund my house off of this, you know.
Yeah, it's an authorship versus a product.
Exactly. And so you've got them pumping out constant new updates, and you're never quite sure what rules you're going to be working with. You know, are you going to be working with just core D&D? Is there going to be a bunch of homebrew? Are you going to be including Tasha's? Are you going to be including Xanathar's? Ghosts of Saltmarsh? Are you playing in Ravenloft?
None of this includes the additional compendium stuff that they do online that retcons certain things because they're making micro adjustments that someone reads in a forum and decides to add into the game.
Right.
That
right.
you have no idea coming in. Like, you could have bought the book, and they're like, oh, no, you needed to get the version online, which has the updates.
Mm-hmm. So all of this kind of comes down to their between being a bloated product and having, you know, a different image than how the game is actually played sets a lot of mismanaged expectations. And honestly, when you boil down human experience, mismanaged expectations, I thought I was getting one thing, it turns out I got another thing. Is the core of most people's frustrations with things.
Yeah.
Okay. And honestly, I think this is the, like, if I were to speculate, this is the exact reason why Critical Role is making Daggerheart right now. Is because they realize that they have a type of game that they want to play, and they have been mashing that game into the D&D-shaped box for so long. They originally played Pathfinder when there was a home game. They switched it to D&D because of the brand recognition.
Without a doubt.
Nobody would have watched them if it was a Pathfinder game, you know? But now that they've got their own standalone audience, they've got a publishing company, Darrington Press, you know?
I mean, they made some buck.
They've made quite a bit of money. They've got a show on Amazon, you know? They have the luxury of making the game that presents the rules and setting that they want to be playing in. No longer need to be tied to D&D. And it's simply because of that. D&D, they realize, I mean, if D&D were a good fit for that narrative heavy style game,
They'd still be playing it. Yeah, there'd still be a great partnership there.
But
to put that point in place, D&D has an emphasis that isn't on narrative, it's on combat, to its detriment.
Oh, well, no. I mean, D&D has three different pillars, Rob. Exploration, social, and combat.
If you couldn't hear my eyes, like, doing the whole, like, shutter flipping in my head there.
He rolled his eyes at me, so I rolled them back to him.
That's right.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I have disadvantage, you know?
Yeah.
No, we even discussed this when I brought up that those three pillars are in the book. They're on one page.
Yeah.
And then never discussed again.
I mean, so you look at the core three books. You got the Player's Handbook, the Dungeon Master's Guide, and the Monster Manual. All right. from a player-facing standpoint, okay? So mm-hmm. I'm not going to talk much about the DM's Guide, because the DM's Guide has a mishmash, a bunch of different things, and there's some of it's combat, some of it's combat-adjacent, like the magic items and stuff like
right.
that. There's rules for encounters in different locations and downtime and whatnot.
Right.
It's a mishmash
of
different
things. And a lot of
optional
rules and things. Yeah,
yeah, so I'm gonna call the DM's Guide like a 50-50 if it's combat-based or not.
Sure.
And a lot of it's kind of gray area. Mm-hmm. The player's handbook, though, okay, and this is the player's handbook. It's right there in the title. It is the player facing product of these three core books. 90% combat based. Mm-hmm. Okay, all the classes are combat classes. Even the talkie class, the bard, is a combat class.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, nearly all of your abilities are ways to engage in combat.
Mm-hmm.
It be it either to diminish the effectiveness of your enemies or to enhance your own.
Mm-hmm.
All active enhancements advancements are combat based advancements. Mm-hmm. I.e., you're getting better to hit numbers. You're getting better, more attacks. You know,
right.
You can now cast more spells, which are 80% combat based.
I mean,
you
could argue like, oh, my spells are stronger, which would include my social spells. No, those are combat manipulation spells.
Yeah,
let's be honest. That's crowd control and diversion.
Yes,
you know it flat out. I mean, any time where the rules specifically state that. You have to decide in your game whether or not people recognize your charm after its releases and puts them in an angry state.
Mm-hmm.
Tells you that it's about tension in combat.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and there aren't anything that helps you. There is not anything in the book that helps you socially
mm-hmm.
anywhere. It's not like the bard at level 5 suddenly gets a group of followers who give him, you know, respect.
To be fair, there are... Okay, so I do want to correct you on that, because you are wrong about that.
Really?
But only a little.
Oh, okay.
there are a handful of abilities in certain subclasses. Almost all of them are in the bard subclasses.
Okay.
College of Whispers and stuff like that.
Okay.
That are ostensibly... more for social gameplay than they are for combat. Abilities to sift through rumor mills and stuff like that. The thief ability to do thieves cant and stuff like that, ostensibly also a non-combat ability that's based in social
okay.
stuff.
Okay, I stand corrected.
And there are a handful
that's
of feats that are things like actor.
Okay, yes.
Things like that allow you to... that are role-play based. Okay, but those are the exception, not the rule.
Right. I will never advance to be a lord.
Right.
To rule people with a level of authority.
Yeah, yeah.
I will never be someone who becomes a statesman. I will never be someone who becomes the head of the College of Bards by advancement.
Yeah, sure.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's not what the game is about. And the rest of this section that goes immediately following it is equipment to do said killing.
Right. And that's kind of where it comes down to it, is that when it comes to player choice,
mm-hmm.
okay, when you're choosing things to add to your character, to your quote-unquote, your build, you mm-hmm. know, any choice you make is to enhance your combat effectiveness.
Yeah.
Okay? Anytime there is input from the player, it is, how do I make a more efficient killer? Okay? It's questions about... Which of two class abilities are you going to take?
Mm-hmm.
All of which are combat based. Things like feats. There aren't really a lot of ways to choose things that deal with either social or exploration.
Right.
There are no choices for that.
Right. Even the exploration stuff that you do get, whether you are good at a certain terrain as a ranger,
mm-hmm.
you know, or you can handle certain experiences, are again a single footnote that basically says you have advantage, or you get a plus one bonus or
right.
a plus something bonus.
Right.
You get to add your proficiency bonus to that.
But all your other choices are: what weapon will you wield?
Right.
What armor will you wear? What wild shapes will your druid have?
One of my favorite things from level one,
mm-hmm.
your bard gets to choose an instrument. In most cases, ostensibly through the book, at a base level.
Yep.
Please tell me what that does for my character.
Literally nothing. Literally nothing. It's the last time it'll ever be mentioned.
Because it doesn't do anything for perform. It doesn't change any situation, whether I choose a flute or a lute.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, if I'm a fighter and I choose an axe over a sword, or a dexterity weapon over a strength-based weapon...
That's an important choice because it's combat.
It is wholly important. Yeah. And at no point beyond that does that instrument ever become necessary or important.
It's only necessary in so much that it is a spellcasting focus for the class.
Correct. In the sense that...
Are you holding it?
Do you have it or not?
Cool, you can cast this. Yes,
right,
exactly.
That's it. Do you have it or don't you?
Yeah.
So you effectively become weaker the moment it's not in your hand, whereas a fighter, they can just pick up another thing and do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it right there, like, I'm struggling to try and help it, and I can't.
And then you flip over to the monster manual, which is ostensibly 100% combat-based because it's all targets. Mm-hmm. It's all monsters for the storyteller to put in front of their players to fight and kill.
And nothing... I will not say nothing. I will say 98% of that book gives you no ability to work around that combat.
Yep. It is. Here's its challenge rating. Here's its hit points. Here's how much damage it does. Here's its unique attacks.
Here's how it will mess with you.
Here's how it will will fight you. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So especially, like I said, from a player-facing view, okay, we're staying entirely on that side of the DM screen, excluding stuff found in the DMG, this encourages players to do nothing but combat, okay? We've said it dozens of times before. If all you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail, right? D&D hands you a gigantic box full of different hammers and tells you that there's three ways you can solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, buddy, I don't see the screwdriver or the wrench in here.
No.
Or, oh, maybe they're buried under all the hammers. I think I'll just grab a hammer. And besides, the most fun option is combat anyways. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I get that, but I don't think it's because people want the combat option with that much ubiquity.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's because you don't offer them anything else, and then you put, like, chain lightning on their damn sheet. What do you think they're going to choose, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Why would I roll a persuasion check when I could cast Odaluk's Freezing Sphere?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Why would I put those things on my sheet and then try to avoid using them?
Yeah, and then we ask why we end up with murder hobos.
Yeah, exactly. And then, of course, you know, you end up with that problem of you've got these new players who came in thinking this is going to be a far more narrative experience than it was, didn't know that 80% of everything they were going to be doing is combat, and the other 20% was enough social to give them an excuse to get into more combat. And if you don't enjoy combat, what is there to do in this game?
Well, not only that, but within that framework, all the other players who see that new person trying to befriend a hellhound...
Uh-huh.
You know, like, well, I don't want to kill it. I want to see if I can make it my pet.
Yeah.
Well, I guess you could roll animal handling. Okay, I did it. So you now have a pet hellhound. Okay, I don't know what to do with this now as a storyteller.
Right.
Like, and the other players are like, you have a hellhound? Well, that's evil. Like, we need to get rid of it. Well, why? I made friends with it. What's the problem? But it feels awkward even to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it should be accepted. Like, they're a ranger. They love nature. That nature's just in a different place.
Sure.
But it's that ridiculousness that even comes out through our conversation that we're having right now.
Yeah.
Says a lot about that moment.
Yeah.
That definition.
And I think for me, the real sticker of all of this is the combat isn't even good.
It's really not that great.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, it's all you can really do with the game of any sort of substance, and it's not even that good. HP is ridiculous and an outdated way of measuring combat effectiveness.
Mm-hmm. The numerous number of jokes that came out of 4th edition and 5th edition about effectively being immortal.
Yeah, what is a hit point? You know?
Like, I could literally lose all but one of my hit points and I'm still 100% of effective as a fighter.
Yeah, sure.
Even the next moment after.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not weak. I don't lose constitution. I'm not even at disadvantage.
Yeah.
I could literally just murder the next thing.
Yeah.
I mean, at least in earlier editions, if you took more than half of your hit points, you had to take a trauma.
Right.
Like, it was bad. Like, yeah. You could pass out.
Yeah.
Like, that makes sense. But, like, I could literally be cleaved almost in half by some kind of, you know, weapon or blazed near death and been like, oh, no, I'm fine.
Yeah, I still got 100 hit points left. It's good. I'm guys.
Yeah.
The other thing is, like, the best option in combat is almost always to just swing for the fences and just try to do as many hit points worth of damage as you possibly can. Because not only you, but the monsters themselves are all as at 100% effectiveness at all the way up to one hit point.
Correct.
So the best thing you can possibly do is make their hit points go away as quick as humanly possible. I was reading a thread on Reddit, a guy kind of bemoaning this because he was he had gotten into a D&D game. It was one of his first D&D games, and he was trying to be inventive and fun mm-hmm. about his combat, and so he was like, well, I'm going to trip the guy. And, like, all the other players at the table were like, why are you going to trip? Why are you going to grapple him? Why are you going to shove him? He's like, mm-hmm. I'm just trying to do fun things, guys. Like, you know, not everything has to be just, I rolled a hit. You know, and they're like, will you please just roll a hit? This combat's going to take forever if you don't deplete their hit points.
Right.
Like, tripping the guy is not effective, you know?
Right.
And then you like, compare that to something like Savage Worlds, where, you know, toughness scales in a way where it's not effective to just walk up to someone and just swing a sword at them.
Mm-mm.
You know, you're just going to bounce off their armor, distracting them, teaming up on them, you know, things like that are effective combat techniques that help lower and mitigate those sort of defenses.
Well, you almost have to say that it doesn't look at it like combat. It looks at it like a challenge.
Right.
How are you ending the challenge?
You know, and there's even rules in Savage Worlds for things like, you know, your talky character who doesn't have a weapon shouting, hey, I had your mother last night and she wasn't great, you know? And that, oh, what did you just say? Oh, he's distracted now, you know?
Yeah.
Because you succeeded in a test against him.
Yeah, and where in D&D you did 1d4.
No, that's exactly. Yeah, yeah. That, and you have to have that spell specifically,
yes.
That bard exclusive spell.
Right. The best you could do is that, or you could open combat and try to intimidate them to not fight you.
Right. You know, you opened a combat in my Savage Worlds game by rushing into the warehouse and slamming not into the enemy, who was big and tough and very scary looking, but into the shelf full of boxes next to him and knocked a bunch of crap over on him.
Right.
And I was like, okay, cool. He's distracted from that. Mm-hmm. Oh, you rolled really well. He's also vulnerable.
Fantastic.
And guess what? The fighter's up next.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, and but that's the thing is that the best options are not fun.
Right.
So
it is literally the most boring option.
And so it ends up becoming a slow slog fest that dries out for so long that the people who don't want to be involved lose interest.
And if you miss, nothing happens, which is even worse. So, like, you're just sitting there going like, okay, well, I guess I'm going to wait 45 minutes for my turn to come back up and hope I do something then, you know?
Which is why when it went to Baldur's Gate 3 as a digital property, it was fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it was streamlined. All of the numbers, all of the things were put down to buttons.
Well, don't jump the gun here. We'll get to Baldur's Gate 3 in just a second. The last thing about the combat, though, is that you're encouraged to have lots of it.
Yes.
And that's the key thing to this is it's like, okay, well, just don't do combat. Well, you can't. You can't not do combat.
Because it doesn't add stress because you're not depleting resources.
Not only is it a combat-based game, but it's an attrition-based game.
Right.
And if you don't have lots of combats, if you try to do what I did, and that was say, okay, well, I'm just not going to run a lot of combat, everybody walks into combat fully rested up with their biggest guns ready.
Right.
And the game isn't balanced around that.
No.
You either have to put your players into situations where they can potentially get two-shot, or you put them into situations where they just walk in, snap their fingers, cast their one level 6 spell for the day, and obliterate the monster you put in front of them.
Or you don't.
Run 8 combats before you let them rest.
Right. Or the hidden thing, which a whole bunch of people are already commenting on, I'm pretty sure, which is, we'll just play with some home rules. you can't do short rests, or you can only do long rests. And again, you're optionally changing the base core of the game. You're not functionally playing D&D.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now we can discuss.
Thank you. We can talk about
D&D playing like a digital product. Because Baldur's Gate 3 is only one small sliver of that.
I agree. But I do want to step in starting there. Because I think it does put to the point that you've always said, which is that D&D is being gamified.
Yeah, it's very video gamey in how its turns work, how it is structured on almost like an action point system.
Yeah.
Where you get an action and a bonus action and a reaction and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And it feels very video gamey, especially because, you know, then you get the emphasis on combat. Combat is grid-based.
Mm-hmm.
And it really starts feeling like moving pawns around on a board.
A digital board game.
Yeah,
if you
exactly.
will.
And so, yeah, this is kind of where Baldur's Gate 3 comes in, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Mm-hmm. But the other aspect of that, and I'm going to take it just a step away a little bit here in stepping into D&D Beyond,
mm-hmm.
is that D&D Beyond wasn't the first stage of digitizing D&D. I remember the CD that came in the back of the player's handbook.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Where they kind of stepped into that because you needed something to help you with the rules as a new player.
I never used that CD. There was a Java program
mm-hmm.
that built characters. I don't remember what it was called.
There were a couple.
But
the point of the matter was that they shipped out a CD because of the rules.
Yeah.
To make it easier
Here,
to play.
We're going to do the book.
And D&D Beyond was literally just the next step of that is that, hey, do you want to play with just the core rules? Or do you want to check all these other boxes and mm-hmm. play with all these other rules? Because it'll be helpful if you have this tool to help you. Like, I remember playing Shadowrun, and you basically needed a digital assistant.
Oh, God, dude.
If you had all of the books and things. Palladium was the same way, but we didn't never got a digital assistant for that. You had to wait till someone made one for you.
Yeah.
But, like, D&D took the step forward of, like, nope. We're going to put all your character sheets online. We're going to make it easy for you to even level up. It'll just be a button, and we'll show you everything you need to do to be able to click through and get to your next level.
And hey, for what it's worth, I actually really like D&D Beyond. Like, I think it's a good product. I thought it was very good to use. It was very intuitive and stuff like that. Now, where it sits culturally and the game that it is representing, I've got some quibbles with, but I like D&D Beyond just from a usability standpoint.
I'm going to be the outro on that is I don't.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's good for them. I think it's good and helpful as a tool, and for accessibility, great.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to leave that on its own shelf, but then now I'm going to step into my upsetness about this and the fact that they are literally forcefully gamifying a product and moving it away from the table. Forcing you to use digital utilities and even a VTT that they're building because it's so complex that it takes away from what you're trying to do with the table. And it puts people further, again, within the zeitgeist of this is how it should be.
No, you're right. I was actually having this discussion. There was a YouTuber that I was looking for reactions like for discussing first impressions of the Daggerheart beta.
The Critical Role, right?
Yeah, the new Critical Role system. Yes. So they just put that into beta testing, mm-hmm. and they were giving out a lot of, like, basically you can get the whole system.
Yeah, of course.
Free print online. There's a YouTuber named One Hell of a Nerd that was doing a sort of a first impressions sort of podcast about it.
I'm just going to ask a question. Young or old?
Younger.
Okay.
Younger. About 10 minutes in, he was about a 50-minute long video or so, and about 10 minutes into it, he said that the dice mechanic, rolling 2d12, adding them together, and seeing which of the two dice was the high one for purposes of rolling with fear or rolling with hope, was too complicated. Compared to the super simple streamlined 1d20 that the D&D has. And I literally stopped listening. And I went back and I actually commented on the video and I was like, I stopped listening to you right there. I said, clearly you've never played any other game system if you think that 2d12, adding 2d, you know, two dice together
mm-hmm.
is too complicated for, you know, for players, right? Mm-hmm. And he actually, he believe it or not, he was very respectful. I was kind of a crappy comment to make.
It was a little snide. A little stabby.
But he actually took it really on the chin. Was like, hey, thank you for the feedback. You're correct. D&D is the only game I've ever played. So I don't know what other systems would do. Mm-hmm. You know, all I've got is my own experience to go on. He says, and I was kind of trying to pose it from a new player's standpoint of, like, if you've only played D&D, how might you view Daggerheart? And so you know, absolute kudos to him for handling my snide comment to him, you know, with such grace. So if you are listening to this, shout out to you, one hell of a nerd. I kind of came back to him and basically said, like, you know, it's not, you can't be perpetuating that other game systems are scary.
Yeah.
You know, because it's already such a big, you know, feeling in the, you know, people don't want to get away from D&D because they're afraid to get away from D&D.
Yeah.
Not because they love D&D, but because they're afraid of other systems. And, yeah. I'll speak more on that in a bit.
That's a whole topic. I'll hold my tongue.
But, and he says, you know, that's true. He says, but I use D&D Beyond, you know, to introduce new players to it, and it takes a lot of the bookkeeping out of it. And I said, if you need a computer to do the bookkeeping for you, that's not as new player friendly. It's not the flex you think it is.
No. You know? I think it's the opposite.
Yeah.
Like, getting somebody into a challenging interface by telling them that I'm going to give you a graphical user interface to help you get into it.
Right.
No, that's...
We're going to play a pen and paper TTRPG. Sit down at this computer.
When people who don't need accessibility tools need accessibility tools to get in, you've created an issue.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And then, you know, also, like you said, the evolution then of that.
Yes,
Previewing their VTT.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, you want to talk about something that looks and feels a lot more like a video game.
Yeah.
I mean... They're not going as far as turning it into a video game.
Right.
But, like, the little characters on the stands are animated. It looks it feels very much like Baldur's Gate, but with miniatures,
mm-hmm.
You know? And I remember back when I was using Foundry VTT, but in, like, the heart of the pandemic, before we were comfortable playing in person again, I remember seeing, like, looking for mods for mm-hmm. Foundry
mm-hmm.
To kind of spice up the experience and whatnot. And I saw people discussing, like, hey, how do you make a mod for an automated shopkeeper so that players can just go to that shopkeeper and just open up a menu and just buy things and it'll automatically deduct gold from their character sheets? And I'm like, why would you do that? And I'm like, so they can buy things. And I'm like, that's like a video game thing. Like... If I were setting up a video game, I would want that interaction. But, like, I wouldn't ever want a player to just, you know, autonomously go shopping in my game without me as the storyteller having some sort of input on that.
Well, the other one for me was that, like, I originally saw a discussion about VTT that I thought was neat, that when they opened a door into a room and it either spilled light in the room or something saw the players,
mm-hmm.
that it would get an alert and you'd get a little pop-up from, like, you could make a guard make a, like, a hey you, or have a, you know, goblin make a noise or whatever, and there'd be a noise file,
mm-hmm.
and it would make it a little more interactive. And I'm like, well, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Because, like, that allows them to then see what is alerted.
Mm-hmm.
And then someone said, well, can you just continue the dialogue? Like, they can then do the dialogue for the NPC as well. Like, put the text there and everything. It's like, no. No,
this is a role-playing game. Play a damn role, you know?
Right. Like, and they were like, oh, when my player attacks, can I have a chat thing that comes up and it randomly grabs one of the voice lines when he makes an attack or when mm-hmm. he gets hurt? And I'm like, dude, this isn't a video game.
Right.
Like, what are you doing at the table besides moving, clicking, and saying, I want to do this attack?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Knox, we see your question. We'll get to you. We'll get to you. I'm gonna put that back in the questions section when we're done.
Agreed.
But I kind of want to actually bounce back to Baldur's Gate 3.
We're bouncing
because again, that kind of lends to the whole, you know, like, video gamification of D&D. I remember when we started playing Baldur's Gate. Thing it was first off, it's a phenomenal game. It deserves every award that it got.
Yep.
And like my main takeaway from it was that the mechanics that feel slow and clunky in the tabletop feel amazing when you've got a computer doing all the math for you. Because it's tedious. You know? It's tedious. They're video game mechanics already. Let's just let the computer handle it.
I agree with your statement, but I will say one thing.
What's that?
It exemplified the problem, which was everybody respecking and custom making to be the best that they could possibly be as an individual. To be the best DPS or whatever. We saw this. Like finding builds, doing customizations so that they were multi-classed in just the right way.
I
You
mean,
know.
you've got this great video game that offers you so, like, I mean, a true immersive sim, if you know the definition of that term, you know, where like it doesn't tell you what solution to use, but there are dozens of solutions, be it stealth or trickery or talking to the right people or finding a key or doing a side quest that'll give you know, access to an NPC who lets you into a location or whatever. Or combat. You know, a lot of, yeah, sure, you can kick down the door. It's D&D, you know? But you've, in spite of all of that, you know, YouTube was still flooded with videos of like insane DPS solo anything with this crazy build.
You know, or stealth your way through and murder, you know, take care of everybody, you know, all of the combat ways to win. And then they would be like, oh, if you don't kill this guy, you get this dialogue. So avoid the combat, not handle the situation differently. Avoid the combat. So that you can get this alternative thing. You know, and or how to kill these people that are unkillable. And or kill them faster or whatever. And it was just, it was so much resetting. And even it did it. Even Baldur's Gate leaned into the combat because, spoilers, the game's been out a while. I'm going to say it. All of your special abilities that you got from the plot itself.
The transition from Act 2 to Act 3, yeah.
Tell me any of those that were plot related and not combat related.
No, they're all combat. Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Look, I'm not saying it didn't further the problem. I'm saying it was a fun game.
No, it leaned into D&D is what it did.
It, as a video game, it was great.
It was great.
It was great. Yes.
Yeah. But I would have just loved to have one of those freaking tentacle powers be, you're good at communicating. Because he was. The master character in it was this amazingly intelligent guy who then used his abilities to manipulate. He didn't beat the crap out of the city to do his bidding, which everybody else did.
Yeah, you know, he manipulated it from the shadows. Yeah.
Where is that? It's not there. You can't do that.
I get you.
You know,
but I want to also talk about like the social media impact. We talked about how, you know, like in Baldur's Gate, you know, you'd see all these, you know, insane DPS builds, but like, but the thing is, that wasn't even new. That wasn't the first. We've been seeing it for years. Where if you look up Dungeons and Dragons on YouTube, I mean, first off, there's just hundreds of channels dedicated to it now. Endless posts on Reddit and whatnot, but so many of them are about, you know, the best builds, insane DPS, which is wild to hear a tabletop game referring to DPS.
Well,
because DPS stands for damage per second. It's a video game term.
Yeah.
Popularized in World of Warcraft and EverQuest.
Agreed.
Where you would cycle through your abilities and it would average out your damage to a sustained damage per second.
Yeah.
Right? Damage per round would be better.
Sure. But really, it's true. Your alpha.
But the fact that people even worry about things like, here's how to build a tabletop role-playing character for this tabletop role-playing game that does insane DPS. The fact that it's their focus.
Yeah.
Is, again, speaking to the culture around the game, you know?
Yeah, those who remember D&D 2nd Edition and its splat books, those books were not full of combat. They had a fair amount of, like, oh, you want to, here's the complete ranger handbook.
Sure, sure.
And in it, it had other classes and the abilities of those classes, but it also went into a lot of detail about who those people were, what it meant to be that class, the lore kind of that sat around it. in a much grander sense versus just a set of levels and the abilities that you get that are combat related around them. But at that time, even people were trying to tweak your perfect second edition character, right? Like, I want a spell slinging, archer who has an enchanted bow and can do these things. That happened then. So when 3 and 3.5 came out, like, that was huge.
Mm-hmm.
Like, once we got feats and powers and shit, that was amazing. Like, fourth edition lit that on fire.
Yeah, sure. But at that point, once you're leaning into that, your role-playing game looks less like a role-playing game and more like a hero shooter.
100%.
I don't want to play Apex Legends, the board game.
It's true.
You know?
It's true. It is true. But that built within those posts and those abilities, and in all honesty, and I'm going to kind of say this, is that name one other tabletop role-playing game that has that.
I mean, ostensibly Pathfinder, if anything.
That's literally just D&D with the numbers filed off of it.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Like, you won't find those discussions. Now, arguably, some people will be like, well, nobody plays those games in mass, so you're not going to have, those aren't going to be mainstream discussions.
Right, but you're not going to find, like, Vampire the Masquerade, Roll a Toreador with insane DPS. It's not going to happen.
Right. There were small communities of that where people would say those things, but, like, you didn't want to play with those people.
Right, exactly.
Like, you knew what you were getting into. No different than Shadowrun.
Yeah.
Like, Shadowrun, you'd min-max at the beginning, but after that you were done, like, that was it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. And, I mean, like, something like Shadowrun, I would almost give a pass on this, because Shadowrun is ostensibly about a bunch of people doing crimes.
Right.
Oftentimes those crimes involve guns and assaulting places, you know? So I kind of get why you would build a combat twink character in that, because you're being hired as a professional gun.
Yeah.
You should be a professional with your guns.
Right. And it knows what it is. It does not lie about what it is.
Right. So I kind of get it, but, like, you can't market Dungeons and Dragons as an adventure game.
Right.
That has these three pillars of exploration and social, and then only build trained killers out of it, you know?
Yeah.
So
this does sit at a place where it's a D&D problem.
Yeah.
Not a TTRPG problem, a D&D problem.
You know, like, you look online and you look at all these different channels that we were just referring to and stuff like that. You got hundreds of thousands of people discussing this game, and their main focus is not on storytelling,
right?
But it's on how much damage can I do in one turn? What is the best combination of abilities to make my character the most lethal killer I can be?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's how you play D&D.
Yeah.
All right. All of this combines, like you were just saying, to make for an experience unlike any other tabletop RPG.
Yeah, it's not, it doesn't sit anywhere else.
Right. The problem is that, like we stated earlier, okay, the thesis statement of this whole thing is that they market themselves as the flagship property for all TTRPGs, okay? They're the quote-unquote Walmart greeter of games. All right. I'm actually glad that Knox in the Box is in our live chat right now, because I had this exact conversation with him when we first started playing a little bit. He was like, hey, I wanted you to run a game for me. And I was like, yeah, sure, I can do that. What game did you want to play? And he went, what do you mean? I said, well, there's a lot of different tabletop role-playing games. Did you want to play D&D, or did you want to play something with, like, vampires, or did you want to play something with, like, superheroes or something like that? And there was a moment of silence over the phone, and he went, there are other games?
Yes.
And, like, as funny as that is, we get a chuckle out of it, but that's, like, that's not an uncommon sentiment.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who only, because of the ubiquity that D&D has in the hobby space, and how dominating it is, there are people who literally don't know that there are other options, okay?
Yeah.
Tabletop role-playing games and Dungeons & Dragons are the same thing in their minds.
Mm-hmm.
So a D&D experience becomes a tabletop role-playing game experience. A D&D problem becomes a TTRPG problem.
Yeah.
You follow?
Yep, 100%.
All right. So D&D attracts new players because they have this multi-billion dollar company marketing to them, and they're pumping up products constantly. It's all over the stores. You can buy it at Target, for Pete's sake.
You can.
You know?
You can get it. I will take it one level lower than that. You can find the starter kits at, like, the dollar secondhand resale stores in bulk.
Yeah.
You know? Like Ned's Shack is a place where, like, literally they had a pallet of starter kits that were discounted. Like, they've hit that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's literally...
It's a product.
It's everywhere. They've reached market saturation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
In the truest sense of that term. So you've got all these players whose first contact experience is with D&D, and they assume, therefore, that their experiences are typical to all TTRPGs. And therefore, all future interactions with other RPGs are going to be colored by this experience, since they conflate one with the other. New players do not want to learn a different system. I see this time and time again. And it's not because D&D is good, but because learning it was such an unfriendly experience that the thought of doing it again is literally painful to them. I have seen this unfold time and time again. Well, my players don't want to play anything else. Okay. Do they know about other game systems? Yeah, I told them about it, but they said that it's too tough to learn a system. Learning D&D was hard enough, and they don't want to do it again. Not because D&D is good, but because they don't want to suffer like they did with D&D all over again. Okay? Just because they think that if D&D was that tough, all other systems must be like it. To heck with that. Let's just stick with D&D. At least I'm comfortable with it already. You know, at least I understand the pain, rather than pain and unknowing. I think also you run into an assumption that if it's the most popular, it must be the best. I don't know how terribly prevalent this one is, but I have seen it from time to time of like, well, why is D&D have millions of players if it sucks so much? And I think it's, again, because, you know, people refuse to try anything else because they believe that they're already at the apex of role-playing games. Like, why would I play anything else? I'm already playing D&D.
Right. But that also speaks back to the, like, concept of moving to something else or even experiencing something else doesn't seem right. Like, you know, if I'm thinking of a pickup truck, I am thinking of two brands. That's about it. In the general social zeitgeist of trucks, I'm thinking Ford and Chevy, because I'm in America.
I'm also thinking of GMC, because I work for, you know.
Right. But you work for it to put yourself in that mind frame. The moment that someone says a Toyota, they're kind of like, oh, yeah, I guess there is that survivability that's there. And there's a smile on the face.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, they're not taking it seriously.
Yeah.
But that is literally the same feeling, the same generation that comes out of that. It has a market presence that then makes everything else seem a little ridiculous to even think of, unless you've got a purpose.
Yeah.
And at that point, you're investing in what you're doing, and most people just don't care. Like, when I go to U-Haul to get a truck because I'm doing outdoor work, what truck am I picking up? More than likely, it's a Ford F-150.
Yeah.
That's what it is. That's what's sitting in their lot. It's not going to be another brand. It's going to look and feel and be a Ford F-150.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that's what it is. That's what a truck is. What a role-playing game is in the mind of social world is D&D.
Yeah.
So if you think about something else or try to explain that a truck is not just a truck, they go, what?
Yeah, and then you end up with people who are like, well, I'm trying to homebrew D&D to do whatever, right? Literally, like, people who are like, hey, guys, I'm trying to homebrew D&D to turn it into a cyberpunk game. What would I need to do to turn it into cyberpunk? And you'll get people just blinking at them going like, why don't you just play cyberpunk? What's that? Or why would I? I already have all the D&D books, you know? Because to them, role-playing games, like you said, just look like D&D. And if it doesn't look like D&D, I don't think that's not what I want. I don't want to do the system that literally invented the genre.
A point that Knox just made, and this is kind of prevalent, is he said you learn to play a new video game all the time. What's the difference? It's just game tutorials. Show me learning than a textbook lesson. And my answer is, but if you don't play video games, maybe you just play on your Switch, even moving to the PC and sitting in front of a keyboard and mouse, you're not playing the game yet.
Yeah.
You just changed your dice from D20s to D6s, and suddenly it's uncomfortable. It's awkward.
Yeah. Remember when I was getting you into Monster Hunter and Dark Souls, and you
were like, I had to pick up a damn controller.
You're like, how do I use a controller? I'm like, you'll figure it out. You'll suck for the first 3 hours of it, and then you'll get the hang of it.
But it took an investment.
Yeah.
To get past that point. I understand it.
Yeah, sure.
I get it. Awkward is always going to be there. But unless the social pressure is with it, mm-hmm. is in the positive, which it is not
mm-hmm.
by far, we're going to be stuck in that loop.
But here's the thing. Do you think that the time investment was worth it to learn the controller? Do you think the experience would have been better or at least equal if you'd have stuck with keyboard and mouse for Dark Souls and for Monster Hunter?
I will flat out say for Monster Hunter, no. It would have been awkwardly painful.
Yeah.
As equally awkwardly painful as it is to play Mech Warrior
mm-hmm.
with a keyboard and mouse.
I disagree.
Once you play with a torso-twisting joystick and all the buttons are right there at your fingertips versus mashing your hand around on a keyboard...
Can't do it.
And trying to figure out how I'm going to twist my torso and my feet separately.
I can't aim with a joystick. I've tried it multiple times, and I wanted to throw my joystick at my monitors. I can't do it.
I understand, but that's how I felt with Dark Souls. Because why am I targeting things with this hand and moving with this hand and
swinging? What do you mean
swinging?
Click right stick?
what kind of bullshit is this? Yeah. But I understood it within the scape of thing. Because it all comes down to comfort.
Right. But my point being is that you got out of your comfort zone to learn the correct tool for the job instead of trying to shoehorn an incorrect tool into the experience and then just slog through it.
Which is the comfort point that people do.
Yeah.
They continue using the hammer and just make, spin it sideways and try to screw in something with it.
Exactly.
They take the hook off the back of it, and they're trying to pry stuff up that they never should, right?
Right, you know? Right.
It's so... And it's awkward to watch it when you've experienced another system. We've gone through a lot of systems.
Yep.
And you watch that, and it's painful. It's hurtful because it's hurting DMs
mm-hmm.
every day.
Yeah. Yeah, because this isn't just a player problem. This is a DM problem, too,
No. And that's... I want to step into that realm. I want to understand... I want people to understand that I think, is almost twice as bad as the player problem.
It is. And this is where the heart of this discussion comes in for me, right? Is that this is not just a player problem. It's a DM problem, too, okay? D&D positions itself as the TTRPG. And the unique combat-heavy way that it plays, DMs learn that's how TTRPGs are supposed to be run. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And this leaves them unequipped to play any other system. I understand, I empathize that looking at other systems looks scary once you've learned D&D, because D&D does not play like any other system. Again, except for Pathfinder, which is just D&D with the serial numbers filed off of it.
I mean, you can go adjacent. Like, for me, between Palladium and D20 was relatively okay. Relatively.
Yeah.
But it was still awkward as heck.
But I'm going to be real with you. Who plays Palladium nowadays?
I'm just making a reference point here.
Yeah.
I mean...
That's a 25 years ago problem.
But moving combat system to combat system, a Shadowrun.
Sure.
Right. Or even, and I'm going to say this, Cyberpunk Red.
Mm-hmm.
It's awkward. It's close. It's a combat system.
Sure.
Not confusing what Cyberpunk Red. It's got other components in it, but it's still a very mechanical heavy system.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not saying not mechanical heavy systems,
mm-hmm.
right? There are far ends of the of the Powered by the Apocalypse.
It's not what you're running.
Right.
It's how you're running it.
Correct.
Okay. And that is with just the combat heavy focus of everything has to be combat. Everything has to be a DPS grind. Everything has to be balanced via a challenge rating and built via these mathematical things to put together these discrete encounters and a certain number of those encounters per adventure to make the system work. Otherwise, things start falling apart if you don't follow these exact formulas, you know? And this way of thinking leaves you horribly unequipped to run any other system.
Yeah. Okay. You end up carrying so much of that weight with you that you look for that pain, that abuse that you've had.
My own move from D&D to Savage Worlds was exactly this painful. And Rob watched it happen in real time.
I did.
I was up on like the Savage Worlds subreddit, and I'm like, how do I balance encounters? I don't see it anywhere in here. Well, I don't understand how you balance these encounters.
You were trying to compare directly. Yeah.
And the community was like, you don't. You don't balance, why would you balance encounters? Like that's a D&D thing. You don't. I'm like, how do I give them combat encounters that won't wipe them off the board? And they're like, well, I don't know. Maybe they shouldn't get into fights then. Fights are deadly. Like, are you getting into fights without, you know, understanding that you could die if, you know, bullets are whizzing past your head? Maybe they should find a different solution, you know? And in my mind, like, I wasn't going to maybe they should find a different solution because I was still in combat is the thing the game is about.
Right. Quick combat.
I need to find them a way to get in a fight that is challenging but that they will win.
And fun. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm not saying combat doesn't take place in Savage Worlds, but, like, it's a more open environment.
Right.
You know?
Right, right.
And it took me months of realizing you don't play, if you play Savage Worlds like it's D&D, you're gonna have a miserable time.
Yeah.
And it took me months to get out of that.
Well, not even that, but even like moving to something truly Powered by the Apocalypse that sits way more in the narrative sense, I remember you looking at like City of Mist and you were just perplexed, like, what's the initiative?
It was Urban Shadows, you're flipping
through the book looking for initiative.
I read that book cover to cover three times because I swore to God I missed the initiative system.
The word isn't even in the book, by the way.
It's not even in the book.
You can't search for that word in the PDF.
There's no initiative system in Urban Shadows.
No.
It doesn't need it. It's a narrative system.
Yeah.
Stuff pops off, you just handle it.
Yeah.
Combat's just a thing that happens sometimes. It's not a phase of the gameplay, you know?
But it's the abuse that you accept to try to accommodate for the players' needs and to accommodate for the game and the mechanical needs of the game that carries with you everywhere you go.
Exactly. The original title for this show was D and PTSD.
Yes.
Okay. Now, a listener of ours was uncomfortable with us making light of PTSD, understandably. And we respect that.
Yep.
So we changed the title.
Yep.
But all of this damage I carry with me from D&D, like, where my perception of other TTRPGs is now warped, is why we wanted that title, okay? I have my own CPTSD diagnosis, mm-hmm. okay? I am not making light of a condition I do not have.
Mm-hmm.
Rob has had long personal discussions with me. He knows a little bit of what goes on with me.
And you know my trauma.
Yeah, and I know your trauma. So neither of us are making light of this PTSD metaphor without knowing a bit about it. Okay?
But I think it's important that we got to this point to explain it, and that is that when we sit down at our current games, regardless of the system we're playing with, there is still the anxiety of completing things to the level of what we did in D&D.
Yeah.
And it causes stress and anxiety and tension when we see it at the table, when it's not even the same system or even the same style.
Yeah, and there's all this unlearning we have to do now. It's like it's like we have to heal from D&D.
And from the abusive relationship that we tried to master.
Exactly.
We tried to dungeon master. I have to say that, because it's there.
We weathered through this crappy system, and it gave us all these crappy habits and crappy ways of thinking about doing things that when we try to move to another thing, we've got this shadow looming over us this entire time. Mm-hmm. And all these bad habits we now need to break. And it's no wonder many people just don't go through the effort of breaking them and going into other systems. Well, and they just stick with D&D forever, because it's, I don't know, safer almost.
Yeah. It's what they know.
Yeah.
It's the pain they know.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're willing to accommodate for the pain they know.
Yeah.
Homebrew, whatever you want to call it, optional ruling, you know, or hand-waving the rules that they don't need but again, they're changing fundamentals of D&D to make it comfortable for what they need so they can master it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's the truth behind it.
All right, so let's come down to our kind of our wrap up here. Does D&D do more harm than good? What has all this been leading to? Honestly, it's difficult to say. I mean, I can tell you what my experience with it has been, and it has been supremely negative. And I've watched the cultural impact of it that we've discussed throughout this episode echo out across the internet. And I think there's a lot of different contributing factors to it. And I know not everybody plays it in the same way and stuff like that. And I'm sure there are millions of people out there having a great time with D&D. And to those people, I want to say your fun is not wrong.
No, not at all.
Okay?
Not at all.
This isn't an essay on why you shouldn't be playing D&D right now.
Or homebrewing or altering or whatever you do.
All I want is that we just recognize that there is a cultural bubble that Dungeons & Dragons exists in, okay? And take a peek outside it once in a while. You don't have to play different games, but understand that other games exist, and some of those games do certain things better than D&D. In fact, most of those games are easier to learn than D&D.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
So if the option comes up of like, hey, should we try something else? Even if it seems scary, give it a try. Just once. Just once.
You may find something that you'd want to incorporate or some style or change.
Exactly. I mean, there's a lot to learn about other TTRPGs just from looking at other systems. I have so many books on my shelf that I will never run. I know I'm never going to run them. But I bought them because they're interesting, because they represent a story type that I like, or maybe an IP that I like. And I want to see how they handle certain things.
Yeah.
And it's great to look at how things happen in different game systems. You can discern. It makes you so much of a better storyteller knowing different systems, you know.
Even systems, and I will say, looking at systems that are specific in what they do. Brindlewood Bay, perfect example.
Yeah.
It's a mystery game.
Right.
It is not a combat game. It is not anything. It is a mystery game, and that's what it does.
You are a 73-year-old woman. You ain't getting in combat.
Right. But it's because it's so hard-focused, it only needs to be the thing that it is. And for that reason, your brain can shift away from, is this a fantasy RPG?
Right.
To, we are playing old ladies. You know, we're playing the Golden Girls meets the Murder, She Wrote.
Murder, She Wrote book club, yeah.
Right. Great. That's such a brain break that it is enough to be able to have fun and learn that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And take that chance, because you'll learn other things by doing that.
And even if you don't ever play Brindlewood Bay, it's a great examination of how to run a mystery at your table.
Without a doubt.
Even if you never play Legend of the Five Rings, there are rules in there for two samurai eyeing each other down. And that duel will be two swipes of a sword, and it's over before the swords are unsheathed.
Mm-hmm.
If you want that moment, read Legend of the Five Rings.
Yeah.
It'll teach you how to do that sort of thing.
I can't remember the name of the game off the top of my head, but there is a dueling game.
Yeah.
Where the dueling mechanics are amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, the rest of the game is about how you get to a duel, effectively.
But, and it's not the one you're talking about, but yeah. Deadlands has some amazing dual.
But the idea behind it is that the mechanics that come into play there, half of the mechanics are about preparing for the duel.
Yeah.
Up to the point where you actually choose a weapon.
Yeah.
And who chooses it for the duel.
Uh-huh.
You know, of like, do you get a choice or whatever? And all of that comes into play versus just the actual fight.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's psyching your opponent, it's changing the terrain, it's adjusting the thing. Do you wait for weather and things like that? All come into play.
Yeah.
Before the physical duel.
Yeah. And again, you may never play it, but having read it, you know it exists, and you now think about those things when a duel situation comes up. And that makes you a better storyteller, because instead of just going, roll initiative, he hits you for 5,
yeah.
You know, you're going like, okay, well, what goes into this duel? How do I make this a meaningful scene for both people, you know?
Yep, yep.
All right. Where are we in our notes here?
I think we're at the sum up.
Yeah. All right, so, sum up, break up with your first love high school sweetheart. They might be your first love, but they may not be your soulmate. Play the field. Date other systems. Browse r/RPG, which is the Tinder for game systems.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Maybe you'll realize you can do better, and you'll be much happier getting away from your abusive ex. Or, maybe you'll find that you've got what you've got already at home is the best fit for you, but at least you looked, at least you know, and at least you made an informed choice.
Yeah, and I'm going to extend that by saying, number one, if we were to do a show that extended this into more of a social discussion about D&D, I would literally have to title it, When D&D Became a Product.
Yeah.
Because the truth of the matter is that when we look at YouTube, we are looking at people trying to support themselves and meet an algorithm that is about a product.
Mm-hmm.
If you remove the term D&D and what they're doing there, and you replace it with any other product, it becomes glaringly obvious.
Yeah.
These people are just selling makeup.
Yeah.
How to do makeup tutorials, how to make the best makeup, whose makeup sucks, did we cancel this makeup? Like, just change D&D to makeup and re-watch those videos, and suddenly your brain goes, oh my god, it's a product.
Yeah.
Because it is.
Yeah.
There's very few stations. There are very few. Well, that's telling for me. There are very few media outlets out there, and we're tooting our own horn here all the time about this, but that are doing it because of the passion of what they enjoy, because they know, and they will say it. The better ones will flat out, openly, honestly say it, that they cannot change, because if they did, it would drop their viewership and they would disappear.
It would kill their channel. Yeah.
This is why we don't have viewers on our channel.
Mm-hmm.
Because 4 people watch this show and 2 people, you know, listen to this show and 5 people. Spotify's never going to put us at the top of the list.
Yeah.
Because they're not listening for D&D content.
Right. Right.
Right.
Honestly, probably the reason why we are at the popularity level that we are is because we focused on all game systems and made this agnostic rather than talking about D&D for 5 years.
Yeah, if we literally put D&D in the title and we had talked about D&D all the time, we would have been a different podcast.
And I'd have been so depressed, man.
Yeah,
I'd have hated every moment of it.
But we'd also would have pissed off a lot of people.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, we would have.
But that's the point I'm trying to make here on the other side of this, is that what you are doing is supporting a product.
Mm-hmm.
That is being supported as a product. That's the truth.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you enjoy the system, enjoy the system.
But there's a lot of other games out there that are passion projects, and emphasis on the word passion.
Yeah.
A lot of people who have a lot of great artwork, a lot of great, really creative systems.
We've spoken with them, and they're brilliant.
We have spotlighted a dozen games every year for 5 years.
Yeah.
And I hope for anybody who's listened to the show for any amount of time has found at least one of those interesting.
We know without a doubt that we have listeners who love the X Without Numbers.
Oh, yeah.
They are passionate because, and there is someone who definitely is not making a product.
Mm-hmm.
They are making something amazing.
Yeah, what is it? Like 90% of the rules are free, and if you buy the rule book, it's a bunch of DM tools that you get, basically.
Yeah. But the idea behind it is it's there to be what you need it to be.
Yeah.
It's not a product.
Yeah.
And I love that. I loved Plangea. I loved hearing the passion behind building it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Right? And you don't get that. I mean, Gary Gygax didn't even play with all the rules of D&D, mm-hmm. and he made that damn game, and look at it now. I'm sure if Gary sat down today at GaryCon to play D&D, he wouldn't play D&D.
I'm reminded of a concert I went to when I was younger, when Sugar Ray was still popular.
Oh, hell
popular.
Yeah.
I forget. I think it was Matchbox 20. I think Sugar Ray was opening for them.
Sure.
But anyways, he went to go introduce a song, and he says, "This is a new song that we're just putting out." He says, "Go steal it, download it. I don't care. I just want you to hear it." And then they just started playing. And to me, that sentiment of, like, I'm just a musician, man. And, like, you know, unless you guys are listening to my music, like, that's why I'm making it, so you guys can listen to it and enjoy it.
Well, Trent Reznor did the same thing. He would release at his own concerts.
Yeah.
Like, he'd put bootleg CDs out.
Yeah.
And, like, USB drives and crap.
Right.
Because he didn't make his money on his music. He made it on his freaking T-shirts.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, he knew what he was about.
But there's a lot of TTRPG producers out there that are making games with exactly that sort of mentality of, like, here, I just want you to play my game, please. I'm passionate about it, and it's not corporate, and it's not sanitized, and it's not mass produced.
Right.
So
yeah.
All right, let's get to these questions, or before we die of old age.
Fair enough.
All right. So I want to roll back to that one question by Knox here. Where was it? Should you try to create a mental wedge between video game and RPG game to better temper expectations? And what's your go-to way of doing that? First off, yes, 100%. Video games and TTRPGs are two different things, and you should separate those things.
Now, I'm going to say to that point before we get any further into it, is that 100% depends on how you're running your game. If the expectation to your players that it's going to be a narrative story, give them narrative examples,
mm-hmm.
movies, TV shows, show them narrative.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you want it to be a hack and slash dungeon crawl, meaning to be a grindy death, explain to them that it's roguelike.
Yeah.
You can use TTR, you can use gameplay, video game references when it's appropriate, because that's the game you're choosing to run.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm fine with that. I think, though, that's where the dynamics shifts for me.
Yeah, sure.
But we aren't, grind story time, you know?
Right. Yeah. So yes, you should separate it, asterisk, unless you should not.
Well, you should separate it because you should know what you're running.
Right.
Set your expectations. Don't avoid them.
Yeah, I think that's my go-to way of doing that. Usually when I introduce a game, I also introduce the idea of it along with properties that would feel like it goes along with it narratively.
Yes.
I remember giving you guys a handful of YouTube videos when you're getting into my Elder Scrolls game, mm-hmm. That were explanations of the lore and the story and stuff like that.
Yeah.
To kind of prepare you for it. But honestly, Elder Scrolls at the heart of it is pretty generic D&D, so it's like it's pretty generic fantasy.
I think it's funny because Elder Scrolls is the one thing where, like, it's a video game.
A video game, but we're playing it as a TTRPG.
But what's funny is, and I'm going to say this, a lot of people who played Elder Scrolls and didn't like it was because it didn't play like a video game.
Yeah, because it played very narratively.
It was, like, everybody agrees that, like, Skyrim is an RPG, and it feels weird when you're not playing it like an RPG.
Yeah, exactly.
So
you don't really see maximum DPS builds.
I mean, you do,
but it
doesn't take much, and everybody's just like, okay, great.
Yeah,
like,
okay, so you broke the enchanting system again. Cool, we already
sweet.
Knew this.
Yeah. Great job, Spiff and Brit. Right. You did a wonderful job.
You made a stealth archer. Good for you.
Yeah. Wonderful. We've done this before. You made a million point archer. Great.
Cool.
You know. Yeah. All right, so next question.
All right, so next question from Nevin. How has D&D shaped the players and DMs expectations and way of playing? I think we kind of covered that.
I think we have a curve that occurred, and it accelerated.
It definitely accelerated. The internet and its popularity accelerated it.
But we also hit a point where there was a divergence mm-hmm. between what D&D as a product is trying to do, and what socially D&D is being portrayed as.
Right, right.
And I think that's the problem we're in right now.
Yeah. Do you know whether the hype of for 5th edition is falling down? A couple years ago, I felt like everyone was trying to publish a game or setting under D&D 5th edition. What's the trend today?
Yes, I do. And here, I did some researching on this.
Okay,
one.
Okay.
So, up until 2015,
mm-hmm.
Which is really where we hit the apex of social interaction starting for live plays and such.
Yeah,
that was really the apex start point where streaming became huge as far as making streams either on YouTube or their own stuff, that kind of thing.
Yeah, Critical Role came out around that time,
yeah,
too, right?
That was Critical Role, technically, essentially College Humor, Dimension 20, Geek Sundry.
Yeah.
All that kind of hit at that point. If you look post-OGL, mm-hmm. if you break the you look up to that point and you look at everything that's been created, the content of stream of Let's Plays and stream content up to that point was predominantly D&D and heavily weighted toward combat and encounter and things like that. But after that point, the shift in the Let's Plays content creation moved to narrative and story.
Mm-hmm.
Alternatives to D&D, D&D likes, and a whole ton of other stuff that got Thirsty Sword Lesbians, a lot of indie stuff. Major houses were now doing all hard shifts away from it. Not just because of the OGL, because they had the chance.
Mm-hmm.
They were no longer bound to that rhetoric.
Yeah.
And it paid off.
Mm-hmm.
Like Critical Role was able to make not just one, but two hard shifts into systems.
Mm-hmm.
They got to play around a lot, because not only did they get to shift away from being effectively owned by someone else for a period of time and doing their own thing, they produced a whole freaking show.
Yeah.
And, like, we're able to basically say we're big enough that we can put pressure in a new direction. And they did, and they're doing fine at it.
Yeah.
That would normally kill anyone else. Dimension 20 did it with grace.
Yeah.
Because they shifted away from we are a D&D house to we are storytellers.
Right.
You're coming to us for whatever the next story is, whether it's a bunch of bears doing a heist.
Yeah.
Or it's Hogwarts, but not.
Right.
You know,
kids on brooms, you know.
Nobody cared what the system was.
Uh-huh.
They cared who the DM was.
Right.
And now we have celebrity DMs who are personalities, and that's the new key.
Yeah, they're running Stars Without Number right now, or Worlds Without Number,
yes,
right now.
Yes.
Yeah. And I hear it's great. I haven't gotten into it, but
so I do think we are in a hard shift from product to people, which is good.
Which
I think that's
great.
Very good.
I adore the fact that I have seen Dimension 20 doing like five different game systems, and none of them are D&D. You know,
I will say this, and I'm gonna say this out loud. When Ginny D does something other than D&D for more than a week,
mm-hmm.
that is when you know the hard shift occurred.
Okay.
When she finally admits that her personality beats out a product.
Yeah. Yeah, I also think that the OGL scandal and the shift to the one D&D or whatever it is they're doing with that is also really hurt their...
Oh, it has.
Their market share.
It has. It changed.
The shine's worn off.
It changed up, and there's enough argument against it, and that's why if everybody's arguing for or trying to move to something new,
mm-hmm.
that changes the dynamic and the algorithm. And I do want to say, I have nothing against Jenny D. I actually love her, but she is bound to a product for the same algorithm problems that everything else is generated against.
Yep.
But she's also growing kind of to a scale of herself, mm-hmm. much like Critical Role did. She's not nearly at the level.
I think it's good that she's kind of branding herself as a storyteller, dungeon master sort of, you know.
She's
thing.
Definitely like, becoming more of an ambassador, and I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I truly appreciate that.
Yeah.
I think it's great. I think it really is great.
All right, so Kilkey asks, the major popularity of 5th edition D&D is based mostly in combinations of widespread choice paralysis and brand recognition. Discuss. Okay, so my answer to this is you are incorrect. It is not a combination of widespread choice paralysis and brand recognition. It is just brand recognition. My evidence for that is the number of people I've seen when you say that there are other games other than D&D, they give you shocked Pikachu face and say, there's what? there's more games than D&D, nobody's have choice paralysis. They're just going to D&D because it's the Kleenex of tabletop role-playing games.
Just like Warhammer is the tabletop war game.
Exactly. Oh, do you play tabletop miniatures games? Oh, you mean Warhammer? No, I don't play Warhammer. It's too expensive. Do you play any of the other ones that aren't expensive?
What do you mean?
Like what?
Yeah.
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 Exactly.
And that's the thing is like if... First off, if you can find your friendly local gaming store,
mm-hmm.
what is in it?
90, is it 90% walls of Warhammer?
Well, it's walls of Warhammer, a full stack of miniatures for D&D and D&D adjacent,
uh-huh.
fantasy,
yep,
and board games.
Yep.
That's what you get.
Yep.
And yes, you can find the other games, but you have to go look for the other games. You have to know. And even then, you're not getting a full selection.
You're getting a little shelf of them.
Right. Because they're not part of publishing. They're not a product.
And it's not economically viable for stores to hold a lot of stock of those games because mm-hmm. there just isn't that much demand. So they order a few boxes of it.
So I guess in a way it is choice paralysis because you have one choice. When you're talking about it, that's your choice.
Well, I mean, choice paralysis means you've got too many choices.
Right.
So it's not choice paralysis. You can't just change the definition of choice paralysis.
I suppose that's true. But at the same time, like, give me another ketchup besides Heinz.
Meyer brand.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
We actually have tried other brands, and I don't taste the same.
It's because your brain has you mapped to one brand.
It was too sweet. There was too much sugar in it.
Again, that's what... Yeah. We're right back to that.
Yeah.
So...
All right. So JJNX asks, having reviewed quite a few systems through your System Spotlight episodes, would you still recommend D&D as someone's first TTRPG?
No.
Never.
Nope.
Never.
Nope.
Absolutely not, because it wires your brain against all other TTRPGs.
Yeah.
And you may never get out of it.
To add to that, even their quick start... isn't D&D.
Yeah.
Like, it's sad. It's really sad, which is why it doesn't sell.
What are some common misconceptions that cause people to turn away from D&D or other TTRPGs in the current year 2024? Some common misconceptions that cause them to turn away?
That it's hard. That it's expensive.
Yeah.
That they're not going to play it right.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that I always get. I don't know if I could do it. I can't do X. Whatever X is. Like, oh, I watch Critical Role, but I couldn't do what they do. I can't be a... I don't know what this means. I don't know what I would do in the game. I don't know the rules. It's too complex.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they just know the rules. And every time I've, like, I don't understand it.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. There's a lot of that. There's, I can't do voices.
Mm. Yes.
You don't need to do voices, buddy. It's fine.
But they do.
Or do them, and do them badly.
Yeah.
And it's fine. It's also fine
mm-hmm.
to not be a professional voice actor and play TTRPGs. You can do it.
Yeah.
I think one of the other big ones, too, is I think there's still a lingering idea that TTRPGs is just a boys' club. You know, that every table you sit at is going to be a bunch of old grognard neckbeards that are sweaty and will make all the women uncomfortable. And I'm not saying that doesn't happen. We all have seen the TTRPG horror stories channels like Crit Crab and stuff like that. But I think it's an exception and not a rule.
I think it's changing. I think that is changing. I think if you're going to look to play a game and you do even a modicum of online research, your likelihood of coming across grognards versus hitting someone like Ginny D
mm-hmm.
or Matt Mercer or types of things.
That's not what I'm saying.
Oh, okay.
That's not what I'm saying. I'm talking about just simply being a woman in the gaming space.
Oh, yes.
And being able to sit down at a table and not be instantly disrespected.
Yes.
And, you know, either A, hit on, or B, told to go make sandwiches for the other players.
Yeah.
Or combination of both.
Or at least the fear of that.
Yeah, exactly.
But I also think that comes back down to who's running those tables and where they're running them.
I'm not saying it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
We've all seen the horror stories. I'm just saying I don't think it is nearly as prevalent as the reputation carries from it.
Correct.
I think there are plenty of great I mean, you bring up Jenny D. I think there's great bunch of really great examples of women in the RPG space that stand as equals, as peers amongst their male counterparts.
And Gen Con was a perfect example. I sat down at a bunch of random tables. Mm-hmm. The females that were there were never disrespected. Everyone was equal.
No, don't call them females. They're more women.
When you're comparing it against beard-wearing males, I'm going to have to say...
All right.
Yeah. No one told anyone to get a sandwich and make it for them.
For being clinical about it, yes. The male-female divide, yes.
The divide. There wasn't one, and that was my point, was that whether we had... It mattered not who was running it or who was at the table. Everything sat equally. That was never even a point of contention.
Yeah.
And I loved that. I absolutely loved that. And I still, to this, I will say to that end, don't be fearful of those types of things. It's different.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I can't say the same for, like, any of the wargaming stuff or any of the board gaming stuff, because I didn't do that shit. But I will say for that part, it was wide open, and it was fantastic.
Absolutely. So. All right, we have beaten this dead horse for an hour and 35 minutes.
Do you feel you've gotten this out of your system now?
I've worked it out. I can be calm about it now.
Okay.
I can be normal.
Okay. Okay.
All right. Thank you all for joining me as I stood up here on my soapbox. Next week, Rob and I are going to be discussing game systems we would love to see.
Because we've gone through a lot of systems.
Yeah.
And we've seen some neat stuff. We definitely have seen some neat stuff. But I still think there are areas that haven't really been touched.
Yeah, there's like weird niche systems where it's like, well, what if we ran this system but played it like this instead, sort of thing. And I will be honest with you. I think next week's show is just going to be painting a giant target on us for r/RPG to go, you know that game already exists, right?
Exactly. Like, there are great rules for that. You just didn't know.
Yeah, it's just here from some obscure publisher you've never heard of and never will again.
Yeah,
you know? Like,
exactly.
Oh, well, it was here the whole time.
Yeah,
it's been here since 1983, buddy. Okay, thanks.
Great, thank you. Yeah, it's fourth version's in. It's been sold 3 times. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Gallant Game now owns it, didn't you know?
Like, yeah. So. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us. You can find us on Twitter at @ST_Conclave, on Instagram at @ST_Conclave. Listen to us live every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern time at mixlr.com/storyteller-conclave. And join us up on our Discord show. We have some great questions this week. Shoot us some questions. We'd love to answer them here on the air. You can find that link on our Twitter as well as our website, storytellerconclave.com.
We'd like to thank our Patreon members who've supported us every single month, especially our name members, Knox in the Box, Subjet, the Arcan Asylum veteran, Huluvu, Sam, Sean, and Sparkle Motion. We appreciate all your support. Our pre-show music is by Arcane Anthems. You can find them on Instagram or Patreon as Arcane Anthems. Our intro music is Beyond the Warriors by Geefrog. You can find them at geefrog.bandcamp.com or on YouTube Music. And our outro music, which you're hearing right now, is Only Our Footprints in the Sand by Midair Machine. You can find them at freemusicarchive.org.
And a big shout out, as always, to our families, Vicky and Sean. Thank you so much for loving and supporting us. All of our friends who've sat with us at our tables over the years to give these great stories to share with you and you, every single one of our listeners who listened to me up on my soapbox today. We love every single one of you. Thank you guys
love
so
you guys.
Much. Good night.
Good night.